And I worked in things like insurance. Like you think insurance is difficult to market, but actually it's a lot easier than marketing a video game, I think.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to Press Start. My name is Adam Andisa Smita. I'm the CEO of Arsenesia and Vice President of Indonesia Game Association will be your host for today's episode. So, as usual in this podcast, we're going to talk about how to become a game developer. We will invite industry person from the game industry to share the experience and their journey jumping into the game industry. So maybe their journey or their experience can inspire you to be a game developer or to jump into the game industry. And as usual, this podcast will be available every Monday. So please stay tuned to watch new episode every week. And of course, this podcast, The Press Start, is supported by Indonesia Game Association and Goethe Institute Jakarta. All right. So without further ado, today we're going to have, a really interesting talk with Igor Tanzil. He has a very, very long experience in the entertainment industry, and right now he become the CMO of Agate, the biggest game studio in Indonesia, I think. So we will hear her story, his journey for coming in into the game industry. So without further ado, let's call Igor. Hi, Igor.
Hey, Adam. Thank you for having me. Really happy to be here. Can't wait to get started.
All right. So for all the audience, to be clear, so Igor is from Indonesia, but even though he's from Indonesia, I think your English is better than your Bahasa, right?
Yes. significantly, yeah.
Yep. So we're going to talk in Indonesia. So hopefully all of you still can understand what we're talking, because we're going to discuss a lot of interesting journey from Igor. All right, Igor, before we start, usually we have some trivial question for you just to know you a little bit better. So don't worry, we are not going to judge you. There's no right or wrong on this answer. It's not a test. So I will start with the first question. Igor, do you remember the first video game titles that you ever played?
Okay. I think the very, very first one, I don't quite remember. It was some sort of, I think it was either Wipeout or one of those other racing games on like one of the very, very first PCs in the very a long time ago. But I know I grew up in a pretty non-tech household, so I didn't actually start playing video games or get my hands on a computer until I was, I think, about in fifth or sixth grade. I think in Indonesia that's about SMP. So the actual first video game that I think I remember installing and playing for the first time is actually Red Alert.
Oh
yeah.
How did you get the game? Did you did your parent give it to you, or you asked them to buy the game for you?
Oh, interesting question. I finally got my first computer, like my own personal computer, around sixth grade. I remember shopping for it. And I think after I bought it, I kind of went around. This is in Singapore. I was walking around Funan Center, and I saw that there was a. This wasn't Funan. Actually, this was back when they used to have this bookstore called Popular. And so I was looking at. So after that, I walked into the Popular bookstore. I was looking around. And they had a bundle package for. The Red Alert series and Command and Conquer put together, because it was at that time it was already quite old, so this is good, and it was pretty cheap. I remember it was like $10 or something, $10 Sing dollars, and so I just bought it. That was the first time installing any software on a computer, first time installing a video game, first time figuring out what the hell a real time strategy game actually was. So that was interesting.
Nice. So you already live in Singapore back then, or?
Yes, I moved to Singapore in 98 after the whole stuff going on in Indonesia during the economic crisis. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's go to the next question. If before we ask about the first game that you play, next is the last game that you play before you do this recording. What It's the last game.
Oh, like literally just like 10 minutes before I joined this this call, I was playing Orcs Must Die 3.
All right.
Yeah.
Do you like the kind of game, the genre of the game? Or
I think I do, yeah. I don't know. I'm at a point where I kind of play a little bit of everything, but Orcs Must Die, I think, is quite interesting. It's a pretty good co-op experience, and I can like kind of farm solo just to get ready for the next hour play with my friend as well. So it's kind of nice. Yeah,
I see. All right. The next question, besides playing games, what are your entertainment usually, or your hobbies or activities?
Besides playing games.
Yep.
That's a hard one. I think game is definitely the primary form of entertainment these days. I think like everyone, I watch a lot of YouTube, watch a lot of like travel and cooking videos usually. And my free
cooking
time.
Videos?
I enjoy cooking videos and I enjoy cooking as well. So that's one of the
interesting
few hobbies that I haven't quite turned into a job yet. So I'm going to leave that here.
Please invite me if you launch your first restaurant in the future.
Hopefully I don't, because it's one of those things, like I said, I basically turned every hobby into work in the last decade or so. And so that's one of the things I'm trying to keep like pure, purely for my own
enjoyment. Hobby.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. So this is the last question. Do you remember your dreams, who you want to be when you grow up, when you're a kid?
Okay. Not a game developer, because I didn't know what a game developer was. I remember wanting very much to be an explorer. I wanted to like find new things and see the world and travel and all that.
Mm.
Yeah. I used to always put an explorer. I don't know. I didn't actually know what it does, what they would do. And having grown up, kind of like seeing that, you know, that you'd have to go to the, you know, far-flung places, I think that's not for me anymore. I'm much more comfortable
because
behind
you cannot
a computer
play
now.
Game, right?
Exactly. No internet,
all right.
No air conditioning, yeah.
All right. Before we start, can you share with us a little bit about your job right now in Agate, your position, and what's your role?
Okay. So I'm in a bit of a transitioning period in Agate. So when I joined Agate, I joined the team as in a dual role. So I was chief marketing officer and chief creative officer. And the deal there was to kind of first figure out how we can grow Agate's business into the international market. And then also internally, we wanted to expand how we create products, how we explore new products, and how we can kind of like take Agate to that next level to compete internationally as well. Because I felt that for me to work on in Agate to take the market internationally, it needed to be on both sides. I can't just market it. I need to see that the products itself are ready for the national market. So yeah, that's kind of what I'm doing right now. And right now I'm working on a new project with a big chunk of the Agate team that can't quite share yet, but it's going to be quite exciting.
It's going to be exciting. All right. So for all of you listening to this podcast or watching on YouTube, so we're going to discuss about the journey from Igor, the starting point from his experience until now in the position that I think working a very interesting project. Let's start with the trigger. Do you remember like the first time thinking about I want to work in the game industry, and what's the trigger back then?
I see. I'll be honest, like, I don't know, like I said, I grew up in a very non-tech savvy environment. You know, growing up, it was all about books. I didn't even read comics. I didn't even really watch TV. It was just books. And even then, I think my dad and I had a very strict kind of like non-fiction book cycle. So I read a lot of history and a lot of that. So making games, getting into the games industry was not at all something that was on my radar.
All right.
I remember, in high school, I was trying to figure out, like, what could I do as a career? What could I do as a job? And what did I like? And I kind of very accidentally stumbled into the whole creative industry by taking a film class. And it's just something that I enjoyed, and I was actually quite good at it. And so,
when was it?
This was in, like, 2006, 2007, right before I graduated. Yeah. And so, again, before that, my typical Asian parents, typical Asian future, right? Business, accounting, maybe doctorate, right? I wanted the medium for me was I think I want to go into history. I wanted to maybe pursue some sort of PhD in history because I love that. I've read it growing up. I've watched movies growing up, and I wanted to pursue that. And I think that having a history major allowed me to kind of like be a bit more flexible in terms of a career one day, and at the same time, not worry about a career. Right? I just get to learn about what I liked. But when I discovered film, it was interesting because it was like, hey, I can create things. I didn't know I could create anything. Film was something all of a sudden that I could write. I guess I've always enjoyed writing, but I never thought of it as a career, right? Because again, Asian family, right? It's not a career. It's not fun. And so I kind of took the plunge. I remember in my last year of high school, I guess in Indonesia, that would be SMA, right? Right before college. I just said, you know what? I wanted to see how I could make this into something. And so I wanted to pursue film school. I think I spent my last six to eight months in high school just literally renting out a camera from the creative department and just making as many little short things as I could. Back then, I still loved playing video games. And so I remember this was the time before OBS. There was this other screen capture program that just came out. And I was like, oh shit, maybe I can make little music videos with out of game footage. So I started recording modded Battlefield 1942 gameplay. And I started recording, back then I was really into GTA Vice City. And I started I pieced these things together into like little music videos. And that kind of formed the basis of my portfolio along with the live action stuff. And then when time came to apply to college, I applied to film school. I applied to a lot of other schools actually, but unexpectedly, I got accepted into film school in Savannah, Georgia.
How about your parents?
They were intrigued. They were more supportive than I expected, but there was definitely some resistance, right? It's, you know, how can you make a career out of film? Especially, you know, like back then, the Indonesian film industry was not quite there. It was very much, and then I soon discovered it was very much about conglomeration of very, very tightly knit creatives, and again, wasn't a thing. So yeah, I went to the States. I went to the Savannah College of Art and Design for film for my undergrad, and I did about 3 years of that, and, you know, learning how to film, learning how to direct, photography, everything. And about
interesting,
yeah, I think, and it was one of those things, like by the third year, I started seriously looking for job options, right? How can I make this into a career? Because then and I was like, I'm about to graduate. I don't have a job. I couldn't get internships. I mean, it was very difficult getting internships in film because it's, you're either working as a PA or you're writing your own things. And I didn't quite have the funds to build something on my own, right? And so quite by accident, again, I took a class called copywriting. I was very young and naive, and I assumed that was about copyright law. So I figured if I want to be in film, I need to know this stuff, right? But apparently copywriting is the act of writing copy. Copy being words, like headlines and stuff for advertising. And so that became another foundational shift for me because I had spent 3 years trying to do this film thing, kind of figuring out that it's actually a lot more difficult to break into the industry. And then I just stumbled into a brand new industry, which is advertising. And I remember very, very fondly, one of my professors, he came up to me, he's like, hey, what are you? I'm like, oh, I'm a film major. And he's like, why are you taking this class? I'm like, I thought it was copyright law.
All right.
And so feeling very, very stupid, he kind of sat me down. I was like, well, you know, see how you think, like, don't drop the class yet and see how you enjoy it. And I enjoyed it a lot because it was a very big departure. Whereas like, if you're writing for film, you're writing big scripts, you're writing, you know, whole stories. And then in copywriting, if we're going to the advertising industry, it's very much about shorter stories, smaller scale things. And you have to think very quickly and creatively on command, basically, because you're working for any number of clients at any given time. And I immediately found that a lot more interesting. I would spend... In film, I'd spend, you know, 6 months to a year working on one project and just trying to get it out. And in advertising, you're constantly going from one project to another, to another, to another. Yep. And it just keeps going and going. And I think that just kind of suited my very attention deficit mind. And so by the time I tried to graduate, I just kind of like pivoted myself. So I wanted to position myself as both film and advertising. I could write and I could make the films. and I just need to learn all the skills in between. Mm. And so I spent the next year and a half trying to fulfill that. So I had all the filmmaking skills that I needed from the film degree. The writing stuff came easy for me, so that wasn't really an issue. Mm. They're just like, okay, what skills do I need to learn? I need to learn graphic design. I needed to learn basic web design. I needed to learn basic programming. Back then, HTML and CSS was still on the rise. And so took all those additional classes and tried to break into that industry. When I figured out that I didn't quite have those skill sets it needed, I ended up reapplying for a master's and a grant, a scholarship, basically, so that I could take the master's immediately after graduating. And I did that. And by the time I spent 2 more years doing the whole advertising, at that time, there was just this idea of professors back then would talk about the T-shaped creative, right? I don't know if you've heard that. It's this idea that if you wanted to break into, I guess, any creative industry, you had to be good at one thing, right? That's your T. But at the same time, you had to be knowledgeable at a lot of other things. And I took that to heart. And so, like I said, by that time, I had graphic design, web design, all that figured out. What's next? I started taking other classes, like working with these collaboration classes where you could work with industrial designers. I actually worked with on a project with a game design class to do the marketing for that. But again, at that time, entering the game industry was not even remotely a thought in my mind. It's just I didn't see it as a career. I didn't know what game development was. I saw these people, you know, doing game design, making games. Mm. That, you know, like, that's not for me. I'm too stupid. I'm just a writer. That's not for me. So I graduated, ended up working in an ad agency in New York for about a year. And then being a foreigner in the US definitely makes it a lot harder to get a visa, didn't get the visa, went back home. And quite fortunately, I decided that I didn't want to work in the ad industry in Indonesia.
Why is that?
Well, I think this is a bit more to my background. There's always been a bit of a stigma for me about coming back home.
Mm. Right?
Even in film, like, I never considered entering the Indonesian film industry.
I see.
Right? It was either I either make it there or I go do something else. And that was very much the same thing in advertising as well. Like, I didn't see the Indonesian ad industry as something that was worth pursuing for me. Right? Either I made it in the US or maybe even Singapore, anywhere in the region, but here. Because for one, I don't write in Indonesian.
Yep.
Can't be a copywriter. And two, and just the work was very different, right? Indonesia tends to be a satellite outpost, so I didn't want that. But the whole marketing thing was interesting. I had, by that time, also launched my own startup in New York as well, where I was doing marketing. And so I had to learn very, very quickly how to be marketing, because advertising and marketing are two very different things, right? Advertising is very much about making the ads. Marketing is about the holistic view of how you sell something. Mm. And I quite very luckily met with a friend of mine who at that time was helping his friend start a new game studio in Indonesia, Batavian. And I said, you know, I'll give this thing a shot. I'll enter the marketing manager. I love games, so good fit. I don't know what this whole game development thing could be. So I just applied. I applied literally by, I remember my application was just literally like me studying how games are marketed, how games are sold. And that took me about like 2 weeks of like just research, just understanding, you know, how does YouTube fit into it? How back then, you know, influencers were just getting up there, right? All these like Twitch was still on the rise. And so I just learned all that for a couple of weeks, made a pitch. Made a very, very basic marketing plan and used that as my kind of like interview pitch to the company. And I think they accepted within 15 minutes. so that's how I got into the industry. I went in from the marketing side, literally just stumbled into it. And now I just refuse to leave.
Before we deep dive into the path that you pursuing into the game industry, back then when you mentioned that you founded your startup agency in New York, was it the same period when you're working in the advertising agency? So you do two things at the same time?
Yeah. So this is the one thing that I think me and a lot of our, a lot of my closer friends realize out of like graduating out of college, right? When you go to your first job, you are going to be both vastly overqualified for the job you're being paid to do. And also vastly underqualified for the job you're paid to do, in that you don't know how companies work. You don't know what they need. And you're there to learn about how to get, how the industry and everything runs. But at the same time, as a creative, I am more than just a copywriter. I could do more than just write headlines. I could do more than just come up with ad campaigns. And so it's a very interesting balance coming at it from somebody like me, where I'm a bit, like I said, attention deficit, you know, mindset, whereas like I get bored very easily. So doing the work while that at the agency was interesting and challenging at the same time, but I wanted something more. And so I think I had a good, my good friend, Eric, we were talking, we meet for drinks after work. Both of us worked jobs till very, very late. It was in New York. So before I'd go back, you know, hop on the train to Long Island City and meet up with him, we talk. And the talks generally revolve around the same things. Like, we can do so much more. We don't have that chance right now. So why don't we just give it to ourselves? And so we quite naively thought we could make, the first idea, I remember this, was how do we democratize stocks where and kind of like fundraising, where you can own equity into these various startups and use that as either sell through convertible bonds or through way where you can kind of sell shares through an online manner. Obviously, that's a lot more complicated than it sounds. And so we didn't get into it. And then the next thought was, you know what? E-commerce is on the rise and I think I can sell it and I think I can make it. So let's build it. So yeah, we built it. And I think we launched about 6 months. So I got to New York, but for the first 6 months, I would, you know, I'd go in to work, you know, 6 a.m., clock out around 6 p.m., 7 p.m., but it doesn't really matter. And then we just go work on that every night or as long as we could remember. Because it just, like I said, for me, like, I just wanted to do anything that was interesting, for one. But two, is just like, just kind of got bored at, you know, just taking orders and doing these things that when you feel like you can do so much more. And so by I think mid-July or August of that year, we launched Shop Kitty, which is kind of like this specific industry focused online marketplace for B2B sales. And the core philosophies there was, we're not going to fundraise. We're going to build this entirely on our own, or we're going to fail doing it. We won't put too much money, that we won't put anything that we can't afford into it. And we're going to build it ourselves and see how it goes. Whatever happens, we're going to learn a shit ton. And whatever happens, I think it would be interesting. And we ended up running it. We grew it from, you know, basically something that we just cobbled together out of a Shopify template to hiring a developer, rebuilding the website, rebuilding the brand, and actually having an impact in the pet industry in the States. And that felt really good. Because by, I think, the second year of operations, we were going into events, pet industry events, and just marketing ourselves as, you're a small business, you're a small business. Right now, you're getting stepped on and basically abused by a series of conglomerated, I forgot what the title's called, but like these massive kind of like groups that would control the industry. And we offered them a way out. We offered them, you know, basically by the third year, we shifted into it, providing them POS service. We shifted into a completely enterprise suite for small business companies to run. And we did that for, since, wait, 2014. We closed in 2021. So about 7 years.
It's also still running when you
were
back.
No, we closed last year. We closed last year. But yeah, that thing kept running. And we even, for a little bit, we ran a small satellite office in Jakarta because we needed to expand our development power. And so we hired a couple developers, popped into a co-working space, and just rebuilt our website in 3 months. Once we got everything, we saw that it wasn't quite sustainable to run the office here. We closed that down, but then we had a brand new platform that we could then expand the business in the States. So that's what we did. It was a very interesting experience. Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, I did all of that was in parallel to what I was doing in the game industry.
Yes. How did you manage that? I mean, that must be crazy. And your client, it must be around the globe, right? It's
yeah.
24 hours for you to work, right?
I'm very, very lucky. I have really good friends. My partners were my really good friends, and they were very supportive. Basically, I had a partner, Eric, who I could trust fully. And so by the time I was in Indonesia, he ran things as CEO. I was just a CMO, you know, based out of Indonesia. We'd have meetings at night, which worked out because, you know, the hours, actually 12 hours is perfect, because then I can do my 12 hours in the studio or whatever job I was doing in Indonesia. And then I could put in an additional few hours after that, like after dinner, because, you know, he'd just be waking up. I would have had dinner and I could work then. And so it was nice. And like for me, for a while, it was manageable. And then you got a bit crazy because I still needed to find ways to kind of like pay myself through freelance gigs and everything. But I think well worth it, because it was one of those things that, like, to me, it wasn't a choice. It was just something that I needed to do to prove to myself. Like, starting the studio here was something that I needed to do. So launching that startup and seeing it through was something that I needed to do. It wasn't something that I just wanted. I needed to do it. And so we did it.
Interesting. All right. Yeah. Wow. That's crazy. So let's get back to the story.
Yeah. Back to the game industry.
Back to the game industry. So you joined Batavian, right?
Batavian Studio back then.
Batavian Studio in
2015,
right?
2015, yeah.
Yes, and back then, your role is a
marketing manager.
Yeah. What's your daily daily task that you do?
Quite different, actually. So I spent the first 2 months studying the industry again. Like we were making a survival game, and so I spent the first 2 months building a marketing plan, getting to know what marketing in games actually meant, especially for, you know, because marketing for big company, small company, these are all very different things, right? Studied the game industry in terms of like what each game actually does and was needed. Part of that was actually writing the blog, and so to me it became very interesting. It became a way for me to like, oh, again, something new, it's shiny, and I'm like, I want this. And as per usual, like I said, always that balance of being overqualified and underqualified at the same time, right? I could do more than marketing. I knew that, right? But at the same time, I didn't have a clue what it took to make a video game. And so as part of my marketing duties, I spent that time talking to every single lead we had. That studio had we were very, very lucky to have some really amazing talent. And so I would talk to the lead programmer, I would talk to the art director, I would talk to every single lead under the guise of filling in that blog content for indie game marketing, right? You need a blog, you need to write about the process. But for me as well, it was a learning process. Literally, I wanted to know how they think. I wanted to know what goes every, you know, what they have to do every day, from the 3D side, from the 3D pipeline, the animation pipeline, the rigging. Like, rigging was a brand new word for me and all that. And so that's how I learned everything. So my daily task for the first 3 months was learning. The next 6 months was building. It was building the website, building all the little nooks and crannies, building a new social media pipeline. I was basically, you know, marketing manager, social media community manager, all of that. And at the same time, building relationships with writers and everything in the US, because I reached out to one of my former bosses who's then working at like Gawker Media. And I was like, how do I get in touch with these gaming people? And he's like, don't just cold call, don't just email, get to know them. And I'm like, done. Sounds like a plan. And that's what I did. So every day was literally coming. I like to come in a little bit early. It got later and later as time went, but I like to come in early before things get crowded, answer emails, usually emails from the States and everything. Then I would do the lead interviews and catch up with the leads throughout the day. And then the rest of the day was spent building all the different assets you needed. You know, you got to think about the trailer. You got to think about all of these different things. I basically had a massive checklist that needed to be done. You know, trips to GDC needed to be planned for. Back then, I believe, this was before Game Prime started in Jakarta. So there was a GDG, I think, Game Dev Gathering.
In Bandung. Game Developer Gathering, yes.
Yeah, that one. So that was the first time that we as a studio showed the game as well in Bandung. So
in Telkom, right? Not mistaken. Telkom University, the GDG.
It was one of the universities. I forget. Yeah. Yep, it was definitely at a university. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's kind of like the day-to-day task. Like a lot of, for me, that's like a lot of playing catch up. It's a brand new industry, brand new role for me. Yeah.
And maybe some of the audience right now have the background in marketing. Maybe they're from the advertising industry and want to jump into the game industry. In your experience, what's the difference between having this role in advertising or general marketing with the game industry? What makes a difference?
I think the biggest difference is that your product isn't tangible. You don't have something that you can hold and like actively show until the game is ready, right? Yep. You're going to start marketing the game long before the game is even ready to show. And a lot of that is about building trust. From the indie side, like indie marketing and actual like, you know, hardcore, like AAA, AA game marketing, those are two very different things. Mm. And I soon learned as well, like depending on the genre that you're coming in, the channels that you're coming in, either you're building for mobile or PC, those are also very different marketing subsets. And so my biggest thing that I can say is like, it's very different. From an advertising sense, you can just kind of create and you have a very specific brief. From the indie side, because that's where I started, right? The indie side marketing is very much about how do you build trust with this team? How do you show that you're not only competent, but you're also making a product that people can trust? Because at that time, and I think even now is probably even worse, trust in game developers is just eroding. Not as bad as certain industries, but there's a lot of like, oh, well, you know, this idea that games aren't worth the time. And so the marketing challenge, I think, is you're in a fight for attention. So on a product scale, you're generally in a fight for attention. But on the gaming scale, you're fighting for attention and time for people. It's like, why should I invest in my next 40 hours into your game when I could be playing something better, et cetera? And so gamers are a very tough nut to crack. Right? They know their options. They know the price anchoring within the industry has been kind of cemented in the last decade because of platforms like Steam and microtransactions and all that. And so there's the more monetization you layer into it, the more complex your message has to be, or the more nuanced your targeting has to be as well. And that kind of changes that whole dynamic. So if you're coming in at it from a creative side, like you have to think about how you reach multiple audience segments at the same time, and then catering specific content to very different, to each one of those segments simultaneously. Like, okay, so maybe maybe a blog content is good for the people who are into indie games and care about the developer relationship, but the vast majority of gamers don't, right? The vast majority of the gamers will only care about the trailer. They will only care about the reviews. They will only care about the influencers who are playing the game. And so you have to manage all these different tracks. Since coming to Agate, I've been hiring a lot of like people from the marketing side, it's very hard to help to, I guess, change their mindset. Like this is, it's not like marketing a restaurant or marketing, I worked in things like insurance. Like you think insurance is difficult to market, but actually it's a lot easier than marketing a video game, I think. Because there's a very clear product. There's a very clear experience that's going to be there. There's a very clear product experience that the market has understood. But in games, you're talking to an audience range of basically children to adults, and they all have very different price points and price expectations. And there's always this continuous like push and pull of trust between developers and non-developers. And it's both fun and frustrating at the same time. I guess keep that in mind. Yeah.
But when you first joined Batavian, are the games already finished or on what phase?
I think when I joined Batavian, it was right before pre-alpha, and so some things were getting some of the core mechanics were starting to be locked in. Some of the core functions were getting there. I think over the next year, we started to get more and more assets that I could actually show then, because you know, for better or worse, people like pretty things. And so until I have assets, like people aren't going to care. Until they see that, you know, monster fully rendered in 3D and it looks pretty, they're like, oh, okay, now that's worth a look. So yeah, I think by 2016, we were just coming out of alpha.
So it makes your work easier, right? Because you have much something easier to show to the people.
Yeah, hey, this much, is much easier. Yeah. Nice. By the time we had a trailer, by the time we had builds to, you know, that we could record and and something more than just concept art, now we had a tangible product.
Yep.
It definitely got easier, but then it became about how do you manage where all of these different assets goes, right? You're managing, you know, multiple channels, and I think that is unique to games is it's not enough to just show one trailer. You got to keep reiterating what it is trying to do, and then you're answering very specific questions because people have their own ideas and expectations about what a game can be. Mm-hmm. It can quickly run away from you if you don't manage and communicate that very, very effectively. Yeah.
Yep. So I think that's really interesting insight for all of the listener who's come from the advertising of the marketing. The challenge with game is like, as you mentioned, the product itself is not tangible. It's something that work in progress, and you need to build the communication, the trust that you mentioned, before even the product is ready. And that's quite different with how we usually the advertising industry work.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So in 2015, you become marketing manager at Batavian. And then what next?
In 2016, the studio closed down. I'm not going to get into detail on air about what happened, but it was not by choice.
It happened, right? In an industry, this kind of thing happens, yeah.
Yeah, these things happen. And so the studio shut down, and I found myself unemployed again. So that was fun. I think it was both gut-wrenching and great at the same time, because that after about a couple of weeks of sulking and generally being unhappy, I ended up starting a new studio with my former bosses. So the guy that hired me and my the president of that Batavian studio, the three of us ended up partnering together and starting our own studio. It was one of those things where we just had what we were building taken away from us. It felt like now, instead of pursuing something that, you know, wasn't ours, let's make something for ourselves. Let's prove not just to the market, but to ourselves that we can do this, that we can make a game. And for me, that was when I shifted from just the marketing side and into the more game developer side. Because then we founded Critical Forge in February of 2016. And I went in there as a creative director. I wanted to build the world. I wanted to write the game. And I wanted to lead the game's creative side, basically.
Interesting. So now your role is a game developer, a creative director.
Right? Creative director there, yeah.
Okay, so I have a lot of questions about this. So first, how is the transition from the before you didn't touch anything in production, right? You mostly communicating with the external from the team, with the gamers, medias, and everything. And now you jump into the production pipeline directly. So how's the transition?
It was both easy and difficult for me. And there's always a nuance there, right? I think the easy part for me was the creative side was easy. I could write. I could always do that. I could make films. That's having worked on film and knowing how to lead film projects helped a lot, because, you know, being a director and being, you know, a game director is not that much removed, except instead of you're just not telling a linear story anymore. You're telling a story that people can interact with. And so that minor nuance made it a bit more challenging, but in terms of managing a creative team, that was a very natural transition for me. I ran teams in New York, and I've ran teams in my startup. So that part was easy. The hard part was managing my expectations with what needed to be done in a video game. And so instead of just, you know, telling this great big grandiose story that's going to have actors and everything, now you have to think about where are the endpoints and outpoints for the players. There's, you know, I think about a dozen more layers of production things that you have to think about that you don't have to think about in film. In film, you're managing film sets, you're managing actors and all that. You do all of that in video games, but then you're also managing a lot of technical issues. And that was a lot of fun. So, you know, the transition, I think the first few months was spent not only just building the studio, but me reading. Somewhere, I think my partner Joe had a stack of books of like game design, narrative design for games, 3D for games, and I just borrowed it and read it. Yeah, and then YouTube, being a godsend, was a great place to learn. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, at this time, I had a rough idea of if I were to make my own studio, I would run it X, Y, and Z way. Right, having mm-hmm. learned from the leads in Batavia and having seen some of the inefficiencies within that studio, I had very strong ideas about what I wanted to do, about how mm-hmm. I could do it better and differently. Better.
Yep.
Wasn't really. So that part, again, with an overabundance of just absorbing knowledge. And then I think I spent my first 6 months, once we started growing the creative team, was just asking them first, right? How much time do you need to do this? What do you need to actually do X, Y, and Z? How much time does it take to model? How much time does it take to create this concept art? And from there, it's just like leading any other creative project, is once you know what people are capable of making, it's about managing how much you push, how much you cut their bullshit, and how much you cut what needed to be done. And so I think in terms of management, I had a lot of growing up to do. I was very young, not very, but youngish. In terms of the creative side, not at all a challenge. Like, it was just shifting from thinking about telling a story in film to telling a story in a slightly different medium. That now I had less things that I could do. I don't have action. I don't have these things on the screen moving, but I had other tools at hand, right? I had interaction that I could play with. So from a narrative design perspective, that was quite interesting. Mm. Yeah. I don't know if that helps to answer your question.
Yes, yes. I mean, as a creative director, did you in charge with every creative aspect, from the how the visual looks, how the mechanic works, how the narrative works, and everything, it's on you?
Yes and no. In terms of the creative side, yes. Again, the studio was 6 people, so either way, there needed to be discussions. So there wasn't a lot of, like, you know, it's not like we had departments or, you know, massive teams that, you know, I could just pawn things off to. But how it ended up happening in Critical Forge was quite nice, because my partner Milo, who is our game designer or lead game designer, game director, would think about purely from a mechanical side. He is an amazing game designer. And I could then just worry about how to build the world and how to then take those mechanics and either build certain stories around it, or have come up with a mechanical answer for specific narrative needs that the game would need. And so we had a very nice, like, partnership there, because I could think about the creative stuff, all the pretty things, how does it sound, how does it look, feel, behave, what emotions I could harness. And then on a mechanical side, Milo would make it happen. And Milo would also then say, like, hey, you know what, this needs to be in mechanically, and this needs an in-world answer, and or needs a narrative thing to make it work. And I would go figure that out. And so that cross-section was quite nice. On the creative side, yeah, it was very much, you know, I had a hand in literally everything. You know, the story was something I wrote. The world was something I built. The art direction was something that I worked with our art director very, very closely. The 3D look, everything, all the assets that, again, I don't know if you notice or know this by now, I want to do a lot of things, and I can't just sit still, especially when things can be done better. And so, yeah, it's very, very much involved in every single process there.
And that's like, to design a game, to direct visual, that's another whole, like, discipline, right? There's another area that you haven't got the knowledge before. So you learned it before?
I think I would say I do it, because, like I said, I started, and that's where, again, I'm very, very grateful for my background, because I started in film school. Like, in film school, when you're making films, you have to do all that. And when you're a student without a budget and barely enough money to feed yourself, what do? You do everything. You need to learn how to light. You need to learn how to color correct. You need to learn how to design the sets. You build the sets. I remember very, very fondly, a good friend of mine. And for our senior projects, I wanted to build a World War II beach landing scene. How do you do that when you have no money and no budget? Well, you cold call a dozen swim shops to be able to rent wetsuits. You cold call military surplus stores to build this look. I couldn't draw, but I could quite visualize already what I needed. So I just did it. How do you then build a whole invasion scene. Well, you build things. You go to Home Depot and you buy wood and you create tank traps. You go to Home Depot, you buy barbed wire and you set it up along the beach and it looks like it. And then you just make do with what you have. And so all of those skills, and I think art school prepared me for game development more so than anything, because art school, my first 3 years of art school, forced me to do things that if I wasn't in film school, I wouldn't have learned. I wouldn't have learned about art history. I wouldn't learn about graphic design. I wouldn't learn about all of these creative things that I would one day need to use every day as a game developer. And then in terms of running creative teams, you know, running a film set is complex. You have emotions, you have very, very strong personalities, both on the creative side and also on the talent side. And I got a chance to do that. And so the whole creative management stuff, I had a good strong basis coming out of both film and advertising, as did that in the agency as well. In terms of the breadth of creative knowledge required to run a game company, art school served as that core foundational basis. And then, at least for me, because again, I used every opportunity I had to learn something. I took classes way outside of my major because I wanted to. And that allowed me to use, by the time I was running my own studio, I could reference each and every one of those moments and skill sets and things that I've learned into that every day. Yeah.
I see. I think that's also one of the interesting takes for everyone who listened to this podcast, that yeah, you can acquire skills on your own, right? You can acquire anything that you like. From right now, we have a lot of courses, YouTube, to learn things. And it turns out to be building your skill set to do the creative director works. By the way, you mentioned that in the Critical Forge, you become the creative director. Did you also manage the marketing side?
Unfortunately, yes. that was probably my biggest failing. I got a bit cocky at that point. Like, I wanted to just make fun stuff. I wanted to be creative. I wanted to build the world. And so the marketing kind of admittedly pushed to the end. But yes, I did end up doing it. And again, small studio, right? At our peak, we're maybe about 10 people. By the end of it, we were less than six. And so, you know, like any startup, you got to do a little bit of everything. Or I guess in this case, you got to do a lot of everything.
True. Yeah, that's interesting. And the game was released in
2019,
right? Yes.
Yeah. So you spent 3 years and about 3.5 years building Forge of Blood back then. Yeah.
I see. All right, that's really interesting. And next, you went to Agate, right?
Yeah, correct.
How's the journey?
It's very interesting. Again, so we launched Forge of Blood in 2019. It wasn't a financial success. Mm-hmm. And again, so that's probably my biggest failing. The marketing side, again, wasn't great. Very proud of what we did as a product. Very regretful about my part in not marketing it well. But then, you know, at that point, I was kind of like in between jobs, trying to figure out, you know, what do I do next? Probably, you know, wasn't really planning on staying in the game industry. Just kind of like, okay, tried it, proved to myself I can do it. Fun, great. Let's see where I can take this now, right? Then I met Arif in KL, and we just started talking. And I think about a week later, we met up in Jakarta, and he offered me a gig to join Agate. And I said, you know what, let's take it slow. Like I wasn't quite sure about, you know, working in Bandung, and well, staying in the industry, to be honest. There's a lot of stigma about being in this country and creating in this country, because there's a lot of challenges there in terms of expectations and skill sets. The process with Agate was actually one of the most awesome things that I could have asked for, because they took me out to Bandung, and I met every single lead, every single and reviewed every one of Agate's projects in 2019. And at the end of it, I just wrote up a big old like report about these are the things that needs to change in Agate. These are the things that needs to be improved. These are the things that are great. These are things that you're doing right. Let's see what we can make it happen. So then the next phase was, what do you want to be in Agate? And I was like, and I don't want to do marketing.
All right. All right.
But there was also a very real understanding that Agate needed a CMO more than Agate needed a creative officer. The products were fine-ish. The products were already running, and the products were generally built out of partnerships with other companies. So it didn't, you know, they didn't need a CCO quite yet. But they needed a marketing officer that could try to harness that. And I think in somewhere about mid-July, kind of like, I think this seems interesting, right? Agate was then and now still one of the biggest game companies in Indonesia. So I'm like, all right, this is a new challenge for me. I'll give it a few years and see where it goes. And that transition was both exhilarating, but then it was like, once I got into Agate, I realized that there's a whole other side of marketing that I didn't know.
Mm.
And enter mobile game marketing. And that was,
all right.
Admittedly, I was a noob, like just didn't know a thing, didn't know like why certain metrics mattered, didn't know why those things needed to happen. And so I had to learn all of that from the ground up again in Agate. And because like I was in Critical Forge, I was marketing an indie game. Batavian was marketing an indie game. And it's a lot simpler than marketing and maintaining a live operation and, you know, free to play mobile game, because that's just a completely different marketing ball game at that point.
Yeah. I think a lot of people doesn't notice that there's a huge difference in PC and mobile market, right? Yeah. Can you share a little bit about what's the difference?
The difference is, I think this is the big part that people don't need to understand, right? When you're marketing a mobile game, especially a free-to-play, extremely well-monetized free-to-play mobile game, it's not just building trust anymore. It's about how do you then be visible at every single point, every single kind of like flashpoint in your intended target audience's lives, and then converting them as many times as you can.
Okay.
Versus at a video, if you're selling a PC or a premium game, get their attention quick, establish some trust with yourself and your audience, sell the game, done. It sounds simpler in context or in comparison to, okay, we need to worry about our D0 retention. How do we get them in? How do we get the right people in? How do we then maintain their attention in game for the next, you know, 7 days? How do we get them convert within the first 3 days? How do we convert in the next 7 days? And how do you then continue that over a period of 30 days, et cetera, et cetera? And what I quickly realized was, at least for me, it was very difficult for me to let go of a lot of things. Like a lot of things had to be fixed, and had to be not fixed, but had to be finessed so that it worked together, right? You can't just run live ops with a completely separate ad campaign that were churning, that were coming in players from a completely different demographic that you don't need. And so the whole data side of that was very, very interesting. Even like the continued marketing, like the just like being able to reduce marketing down to just a few ratios, right? We need this demographic costing X amount of money and within this amount of budget, and we need to maintain that demographic for X number of days. And that's all you really needed to care about. And then at that point, if you see a lot of the mobile game ads, there's a reason why creative takes a back seat, because it doesn't, if you get the right demographic, then you get the targeting right, creative starts to matter less. And for me, that's like, it's very difficult to let go, because I'm coming at it from a creative background route where, for me, marketing is all about story. Brand matters, right? Creative matters. And so coming to terms with, I guess, measuring both of that was an interesting challenge in the last few years.
Yep. Is it safe to say that marketing in mobile is more difficult than for PC market?
Yeah, I think for me. For someone like me that is a lot more creatively minded, I think it's very, very difficult. I think for the marketing guys who are a little bit more analytically minded, it's very, very simple. Right? I know how to reach X demographic. This is the budget I have to play with. Therefore, you can quickly infer follow-on statistics because of those things. And if you are able to just treat the marketing completely that way, it's not that bad. But if you're also then like, okay, then if you're also trying to manage, how does the overall brand feel and what happens to the overall game company and to the studio reputation and all of that in conjunction with that, then it becomes a bit more of a complicated dance. Right.
I see. So for you to work as a marketing in mobile games and in PC games, the skill set needed is different, right?
Yeah. And I think the thing with Agate that made it very a particularly challenging thing was that a big chunk of our products are mobile. Mm. We also have a big chunk of our consumer games being PC and console based. And then we also have a B2B marketing. And so at that point, the company's image matters a lot more. And so you can't just make the fake ads that a lot of mobile game companies do because it reflects badly on the company. And at the same time, you can't not do that as well, because that's the quickest way to get eyeballs for any specific mobile game. And so that's the constant struggle, right? Building both not only Agate's visibility as a company, but also building the visibility of these products individually.
Yes. Balancing between the mobiles and the PC market itself is already hard, but you added another business, which is the
service layer.
Yes.
Yeah. Which you're quite familiar with, right? And so it's a constant struggle. The nice thing with the gamification side, honestly, that's it's less of a challenge because we both those divisions, the mobile game division and the consumer games division, becomes that core foundation for, you know, going to companies. Well, these are our products. If we can entertain these people, we can definitely do that for your company. We can definitely do that for your marketing needs. And so that's not the difficult. The difficult part is then how do we then push valuation in Indonesia? Right? Again, I think a common theme for me is like there's always that stigma about building things here in Indonesia. It's because the price points aren't there. The talent quite often isn't there. I think you being CEO of Arsenija, like you're quite aware of how difficult it is to retain people and to find good talent here and to train them up, which is, I think, the great thing that Agate has been doing is training that core, that next generation of game developers. I think that's key. But as of now, it's an uphill battle.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, how do you maintain specific product qualities across all three divisions? How do you then train the next generation and then convince a client that, you know what, games take time, games take money, and the price points for our products are a lot higher than most people are willing to pay for.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But the good thing about the game industry itself, right, it's borderless, right? So when you create in Indonesia, you can publish it around the world. Yes.
Yes and no. I think and that's where the quality starts to matter. Right. I think Indonesia, and I think that a lot of Southeast Asian countries are marred by a certain lack of leadership in terms of quality, and there's a certain good enough mentality that is pervasive in the creative industry here. And for me, that's the biggest cultural shift that needs to change in both Indonesia and in all of the companies working. Like, it's not enough to just say like, oh, if we can reach X number of Indonesians, then the rest will come. No. It should be the other way around. Let's reach for the top. Let's make sure that we can function internationally first. Then the Indonesians will come.
Yes, I think culturally it's also right that, right? If you this is the Indonesian game, I think nobody cares. But when we say that this is the game that already successful globally, I think the market still try to look into the game too.
Exactly.
Yep. Did you find any? I mean, extreme difference between working. How big is the team? Was the team when you're working on the Batavian?
Batavian was about 40 to 50.
Oh, it's already quite big, right? So, did you find any difficulties when transitioning into Agate with hundreds of crew?
Yeah, I would say because Agate was so large, the cultural dissemination and the dissemination of knowledge becomes harder. I think for me, it was very much an uphill battle about how do I challenge things within a company. For me, with Critical Forge of 6 people or 10 people, I can teach, I can train that people, I can hammer it down to, you know, this is the way that needed to be done, and these are the philosophies that we need to establish. Great, but with 300 people, you can't do that.
Yep.
Especially with 300 people that have been working together for a decade. long before I came in, and then I'm just some jackass coming in like, oh, you guys are doing X and Y wrong. You got to do this. Like it's a very different mindset. And so the shift from going from, you know, team of 50 to team of like 10 to team of 300 with direct reports numbering the dozens is about managing just a larger scale of varying personalities. And how do I need to then temper both my expectations and also my communication skills that needed to be refined and to actually, you know, get across what I needed to happen on a company level, on a team level, and on an individual level. That was, I think, the biggest shift.
Yeah. I see. Igor, I still have a lot of questions that I want to ask, okay. But unfortunately, we already over time, almost right. 1 hour.
Yeah.
So to close this session, do you have any tips or trick for everyone who want to start their career in the game industry?
Learn as many things as you can. Because it's one of those things, like things that you don't think would be useful. If you're in any creative industry, everything is useful. The biggest advice that I give to young creatives or young artists or whatever who say like, oh, I want to be a director one day. Like, what do I need? And the thing is, like, to be a director, to be anything, you don't have to be the best in your particular field. You don't have to be the best artist. You don't have to be the best writer. But you need to be able to think very, very quickly and think in a lot of different mindsets. The wealth of experience that you're going to get by learning as many things as you can will beat any sort of single mastery in any one point, in any one skill, I think. That's at the point, like, it's the more you know, the more you know. There's no way around it. There is no shortcut to experience. And so, give yourself the opportunity to learn as many things as you can. Even if it looks weird, like, why would you take a fashion class? Because it's interesting. Mm-hmm. Why would you take, you know, a game design class or whatever? Like, because it's interesting. So be curious. Yeah, be curious and learn as much as you can. Because everything matters at the end of the day. And all those skills in game development, especially, will be useful in one form or another.
Yeah. Amazing. Thank you so much, Igor, for your time today. All right. So, everyone, I think that's it for today's. I hope this session can help you to give you courage and to give you confidence to press start becoming a game developers. I'm Adam Anissa Smita. Thank you for listening. Keep playing games and start making games. Bye-bye. Thank you, Igor.
Thank you. Bye.